Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. Today is Monday, June 24th. This is host Richard Benulli. Today we have returning guest Charles Hugh Smith. Charles is author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of several books on our economy and society. And he's also has a Substack that he set up most recently in a blog of twomines.com that has been rated as one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. It's my pleasure to talk about today's very big topic, geopolitical and financial repression related risks.
Yeah, so we want to take a look at a Substack called cedarowl.substack.com that we've helped them to put together a risk table that we're one of the inputs into that table. And it's an ongoing table. It's kept live. It's kept up to date live. There's also some assessments of the likelihood of certain risks to happen. And the risks are focused on various geopolitical risks and related financial repression type of risks. And so these are assessed row by row as to likelihood of it happening. And also the impact to investors, high, medium, low type of ratings. There's a lot of links that are embedded in the evaluation, in the assessment of each row. And there's potential adverse actions that are identified, potential risk to the investor, and some ideas on how they are in terms of their portfolio at Cedar Owl and their entity in terms of doing investments, what assets or securities that they're looking at to mitigate that risk. They also have a portfolio set up there, the Cedar Owl portfolio. That's what we'd like to discuss. There's several links also that are embedded, which go to your blog, Charles, that relate to many of these. So your initial thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think it's a great topic, Richard, that a lot of these ideas or potential threats or crises, brewing crises, get a lot of coverage. But it's a good sort of thought process to look at the totality of them. And that way we can see how they connect or have a better context for assessing each of these risks. So, I'm hoping you'll kind of start and go through each potential issue, and then I'll comment.
Okay, great. The first one is on what's been called the Great Taking, based on a book by David Rogers Webb. And that is encompassing several potential scenarios which are increasing in likelihood. The assessment is initially low, but the likelihood is increasing, especially as interest rates and inflation rise, triggering a potential event that could serve as a catalyst for the so-called Great Taking to happen. And what is the Great Taking? So it's essentially the confiscation of certain assets, in particular like equities, bonds, cars, even homes that are financialized. And you've written a lot about this, Charles, on financialization. And so what it is this Great Taking is the potential for that confiscation to happen through an entity which includes these assets as collateral on the underlying. So what that means is like a collateralized loan obligation or asset-backed security, mortgage-backed security, or equities as a collateral or an asset class. And so since about the year 1994, a lot of the regulations and legal framework has changed to allow this potential to happen. And one of the specific references is Article 8 of the Uniform Commercial Code. So that, and there's other documents too that can be investigated. We include a number of links on this. So the idea is, even if you have a car that's fully paid, if it's under a collateralized loan obligation on somebody's or some entity's books, it could be subject to a confiscation should that CLO come into problem. And equities as well, particularly equities where there's some debt component or it's owned through a street name of a brokerage company. So that's also potential because what that means is like owning shares. Most people will own shares through a brokerage. If you call the company, they won't necessarily have your name as owning that. The name of the brokerage firm, like Charles Schwab, for example. But there are some ways to mitigate that risk. And but yeah, just wanted to get your initial thoughts on this one, Charles.
Yeah, I'm interested in this as an example of something that's pretty well known in the financial sector, which is a collateral that's the foundation of some loan. Like, for instance, a house is the foundation collateral for a mortgage. And so there is typically, you know, in every loan or mortgage document, there is a mechanism for the lender to acquire or take back the collateral. And it's usually as a result of non-payment, you know, default and that kind of thing. There's a mechanism for that. But what we're talking about here is the next step in that chain, which is that when the asset has been bundled into a derivative that has a claim on collateral, that there could be like a domino effect, and in which assets are called, collateral is called basically by entities that had nothing to do with the initial loan initiation. And so that's where people who follow this kind of stuff more closely than I do, why they see this as a risk is the derivatives that are out there are often quite complicated. And some of them, at least the ones that blew up in 2008, they can be related to interest rates or LIBOR rates, and they can include all sorts of assets mixed together as packages, some of which have nothing to do at all with the loan that your mortgage might be bundled in with a derivative that's connected to LIBOR interest rates or something. So how that plays out is a risk because it's simply an unknown. And I just want to mention that possibility of political action in this, because if, you know, 20 million homeowners suddenly find their homes have been seized by some as a result of some derivative waterfall or cascade, there's going to be political blowback that's going to occur to not allow that to happen. I mean, you know, you're not going to be able to have that kind of taking and have people just accept it as the way the system's supposed to work. So then that could trigger another wave of uncertainty and risk. So there's multi-levels to this.
Yeah, those are great points, Charles. And the table goes on to mention some of the risk mitigation measures on this, in particular highlighting investment asset classes or ways of investing, storing values, precious metals, land, equities of certain companies that may make sense, and this applies to all of the risks presented. One area in particular that is of interest is doing a DRS transfer, meaning looking at the process of getting a physical equity certificate or the equivalent of a physical security certificate, equity certificate that is presented in more of an online format for modern holding of a physical certificate instead of holding it physically, but the same effect, thereby taking it off the books of the brokerage firm and street name, owning the company directly, really truly representing ownership of the company, especially with no debt involved, and also off the books of the depository trust company DTC as well. So that's called a DRS transfer. A lot of brokerages can also help. The costs are very minimal, or in some cases, zero on that. So, can we take a look at another one or on this?
Sure.
Yeah, let's look. The next one is about the potential for a cyber attack. And this could be in the form of a denial of service attack, where this, continuous internet packets are bombarding an online server or site to the point of the service not being able to be operated or accessible in some way. Could also be accompanied by, widespread power outages, attacks on subsea cables that are involved in the internet, and Dr. Has written about this, pointing out also, like recently, the 9/11 networks went down across South Dakota, Nebraska, Nevada, and Texas on April 18th. This could lead, the table goes on to point out, the potential for governments at that point to institute digital IDs, for controlled access to the internet. And that then could be accompanied by government controlled central bank digital currencies, which would m most likely be implemented by the commercial banks on behalf of the central banks. So they're assessing the potential for this as medium risk at the moment. And there's even been some, instances of growing different types of cyber attacks happening. The types of investments or mitigation measures are, as mentioned before, and also equities of companies in areas providing disaster recovery, business continuity, security type services may be interesting to look at. Is what they say. They look at those for potential risk mitigation measures. Your thoughts on this, Charles?
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
Yeah, this is definitely a big topic that is in the news most recently due to the shutdown or the hacking of a software that new car dealers use. And so it's basically shut down the new car dealerships in the United States, or certainly greatly inhibited their business, their function. So, and the hacking or DOS, as you say, denial of service, the idea here is that you get it's a blackmail, right? If they pony up X number of dollars, then, you'll stop the attack. So there's a monetary value there to, you know, basically mafia types or criminal organizations. But there's, of course, the larger value to geopolitical enemies, where and it's well known that every major nation has large investments in hacking and disrupting other countries' internet systems. And through those hacking technologies, potentially disrupting their entire utilities, or as you said, the 9/11 system. And so this has created, being so dependent on digital technology connected to the internet, has created a huge range of vulnerabilities. And it seems that the primary risk mitigation is to reduce your dependency on those systems to whatever degree you can. So for instance, having a month's expenses in cash, you know, assuming we still are able to use cash, that's one way to do it. And of course, as the chart says, you can own tangible assets that you can access and turn into cash, such as precious metal coins and so on. So there's that, but in a geopolitical sense, there's a lot of risk factors that we don't really have a lot of history on. In other words, when it comes to nuclear weapons, which we'll discuss later, there's a long history of interactions and negotiations and crisis management between the nuclear powers over the last, say, 60, 70 years. And so there's some history of how to resolve these issues, but with this kind of geopolitical hacking, how would the United States respond if another nation crippled its utilities across the nation via an internet-based attack? Is that considered the same as a nuclear weapons strike or a terrorist bomb? I mean, exactly where does it fit into the structure of response? And so you can say, well, you suffer an internet outage, then you attempt to do the same to whoever did it to you, or you might decide to bypass that and use physical force, and then you're into another area of escalation that's risky because mistakes are just so easy to make when you're starting to escalate the use of force. So I would say that's part of it. Is if you're just going to take down an occasional bank or a network, but if you were going to make a serious strike that disrupted another nation, and that nation had nuclear capacities, then they're going to be very tempted to do something equivalently destructive. And it may not be the internet. They may take out your utilities directly. And then you're in an escalating war without a lot of, as I say, not a lot of historical history or infrastructure, if you will, to kind of limit it. So that would be my concern.
Yeah, exactly, the response. And actually, the next two of the risk in the table, the next two rows are also different types. So one row talks about tariffs for imports and or exports between indebted Western world countries, meaning U.S., Canada, U.K., Western Europe, and versus the global South countries, which have much less debt. So that you could have the tariffs, right, imposed given the accelerating multipolar world that we're living in, making it almost a two-fold pronged approach, depending on if you're an investor in the Western world versus an investor in the global South world, right? What types of investments make sense, and in which jurisdictions can you invest, or should you invest, in terms of considerations for investments. And also the another row speaks to the sanctions. So initially there was a freezing of the Russian assets held by the West, and now they've gone to the next stage of confiscating our assets. So some recent developments that 50 billion looks like it's going to be confiscated. The Russians had 300 billion approximately of US bonds. Initially, it was mostly in the US, and approximately 225 billion or so was moved to Europe. And there was initially a freezing of those assets, but now a movement to confiscate the actual capital, in addition to some initial movement of applying the yield coming out from the bonds to Ukraine. Now it's actually selling of the asset itself. So this is a particular concern because it's, and this has been pointed out by many podcasts participants that we've also participated in with Louis Vincent Gay, for example. It's an undermining of the rule of law. He points out where before a long time, for decades, especially the US was considered a solid rule of law, and everybody was equal under that law, and there was no discrimination, right, between countries or citizens of countries, certain religions or different areas of the world. So, but now it's moving into that realm. So this is making a lot of concern, which also affects the bond market as well. We'll get into the into that shortly, yeah, it's an issue, and the risk mitigation here pointed out is for a minimization of European securities like equities and European listings, and even equities listed on New York Stock Exchange and other non-European exchanges representing shares of European companies, you know, to be watchful at on that. Your thoughts on this, Charles?
Yeah, let me take the tariff issue first. And I've written a bit about this in my book, Global Crisis, National Renewal. And my basic approach to this idea of tariffs is that national security has now become an issue in trade, where for the glorious 20 years between China's entry into the WTO in 2001 and the COVID pandemic era, those decades were dominated by the idea that markets are problem-solving mechanisms. That's all we need. And everybody benefits from globalized trade. And so what's new now is that people are recognizing that supply chains are actually part of your national security. Because if you depend on a frenemy, so to speak, the way that the US depends on China for the components for pharmaceuticals and so many other materials and products, then when they if they were to cut you off, then you would it would be like the equivalent of an economic disaster. Like they could render you, they could incapacitate your economy because you allowed yourself to become dependent on an unreliable source for your essentials of your economy, whether that would be capital or products or materials. And so introducing supply chains and resources as factors in national security changes the whole trade idea from let's all sing kumbaya around the World Trade Organization to a completely fragmented world where every element of trade, resources, and capital are a means of war by, in other it without being like a use of force. In other words, everything becomes a geopolitical, part of a chess game. And so I can foresee where national interests are best served by abandoning the World Trade Organization and so-called rule of law organizations that are trying to treat everybody equally and just throwing those overboard and seeking to cut deals individually with between nations. And so, for example, to use your idea of the global South having being the source of many commodities, I could easily imagine a country such as the United States or China wanting to cut a deal with a specific supplier, like, for instance, Indonesia, of materials, and say, well, we're going to give you zero, you know, cut tariffs to you, and we're going to give you protected nation status or whatever. And as long as you secure the materials that we need, you know, to buy from you. So, and that makes perfect sense, you know, in the terms of national security. It doesn't make any sense in terms of markets being solutions. But that's no longer viable. That's not good enough anymore. You know, you've got to protect your national interests. Then the other distinction I think we need to make is between mercantilist economies like China, which is their economy is largely dependent on global trade, exports, what we would call classic mercantilism, like barriers to imports, while they seek every opportunity to export huge quantities of goods and services, right? That's a mercantilist economy. Other examples, Japan, Germany, South Korea, so on. So the way that or limit the power of these mercantilist economies is you cut them off at the knees by putting up steep tariffs. And so China, for example, is by some reports, is gearing up to produce, you know, 50 million extremely cheap EVs, electric vehicles, right? The cars that sell for $10,000 or $15,000. And obviously they're not going to be of the same quality or durability of a car that costs $45,000, but they're hoping to dominate the world market in a mercantilist fashion, right? And so all of their trading partners are now wary of this because they don't want to see their own domestic auto industry destroyed just so consumers can buy a low quality, low price vehicle, right? So national security also includes protecting your key industries. And so tariffs are going to be like the way it's going to be. There's no other tool that's quite as powerful to limit your dependence on mercantilist economies. And it's, in terms of resources, a lot of the environmental stuff that's gone on in North America and in other countries as well has been aimed at essentially offshoring all the nasty, dirty business of mining and smelting metals to some other country who then has to absorb all the industrial pollution. And so that that kind of set of values is going to be set aside, and there's going to be mining that has been banned or closed for decades in the United States is going to start kicking up again. And we see this in various conflicts already arising where mining for lithium and uranium are of national security here. And so the environmental movement is going to find that national security is more important to the national interests than offshoring all the dirty stuff to some other country. So those are some of the issues that are bound up with the risk of tariffs. What does it mean for us as consumers? Well, higher prices, but also more secure supply chains, which are a benefit to us, because if somebody can cut off the supply of your pharmaceuticals, that's a risk, not just to the nation, but to consumers.
Yep. Those are great points and examples, Charles. The next one, also you mentioned China, relates to the idea leveraging also from the sanctions that there's now concern by China and other global South central banks because of what has happened to Russia. On their situation by holding the the bonds. So, put yourself in their shoes, they might be saying, oh, this we could be next, right? So you have China now not only not buying government bonds from the Western world, but selling their existing holdings. There's been reports up to like 53 billion was the recent number in recent months, but continuous slow, quiet selling happening, and so this brings up the risk from a geopolitical sense, resulting in who will fund the debts, right? Who will fund the deficits of the Western world, deficit spending, and the rollover of the debt. Because without buyers, you would have a potential for interest rates to go higher and bond prices, therefore, to go lower. This would, basically provide a risk to investors holding bonds, right, where the capital goes much lower as interest rates on the bonds goes higher. We've seen that already happening. So the question is, who will be buying the bonds? Where will the buyers come from? Well, to date, there's been some buying that's either encouraged or forced through regulations like the Basel Accord for financial institutions, insurance companies, pension funds, banks to buy bonds, which with no haircut, no cut. In applying the value of those bonds towards maintaining, for example, unexpected losses, coverage for unexpected losses per the Basel Accord. There's been encouragement through that, through regulation to buy bonds. But also, you've written recently that we could be seeing as well the potential for changes either in registered accounts, such as 401ks, IRAs in the US, RSPs, RIFs in Canada. It could be a change there to require 50% of the account holders holding of assets in that account to be government bonds, right, of that jurisdiction of the US or Canada, for example. And on unregistered accounts, you put out a recent blog post on this. For the potential of very high taxation rates on investments like equities and corporate bonds, perhaps with either zero or low taxes on government bonds, right? Maybe 0% on capital gain for corporate, sorry, for government bonds, and 0% and/or 0% for the yield distribution. Your thoughts on that, and also if you can comment on your blog post, Charles.
Yeah, thank you, Richard. I want to introduce two contexts here for this discussion of national, sovereign central banks selling bonds or such as U.S. Treasuries to avoid sanctions that could occur in a conflict, and also just to kind of reduce their exposure to U.S. dollar holdings. Which is, of course, a big topic a lot of people have talked about. But I want to introduce the larger context, which is a dramatic reshuffling of the entire global economy's capital flows. And I see that this these issues about bonds and bond ownerships or selling, they're part of a much larger reshuffling that includes other pieces. For example, China has long depended on what we call FDI, foreign direct investment, where foreign non-Chinese capital has flowed in and into Chinese assets to build factories and so on. And so a lot of developing world countries depend on FDI for their capital. And so if somebody starts selling your bonds, and you consider this an unfriendly act, then you can then seize up or limit the direct investment capital that flows out of your country to their country. So you can, and there's a lot of mechanisms for doing this. For example, in the U.S. Tax code, All assets, all income, everywhere on the planet are considered taxable in the United States, right? So there are ways that if you've paid the tax on the on some income in another nation, that you know you're not double taxed. But the idea is that if I could easily imagine a scenario in which the income from your direct foreign investment in another nation is taxed at an extremely high rate, so that the incentive to invest overseas is removed, because you're basically going to get nothing. All your earnings are going to be taxed away, and there may even be a wealth tax imposed on foreign assets. So, for example, so then it would be like, well, double whammy. Why would I invest in foreign bonds or foreign direct investment? And then alternatively, like I cover in my blog post you mentioned, if you want to encourage your domestic capital to invest in your sovereign bonds, your treasuries, then of course you make the tax zero. There's no income tax on the interest from treasuries, for example, which is already the case in states in the United States. The state income taxes do not apply to treasury bond interest. So you would, and then you'd raise the taxes on all capital gains, and maybe impose a little wealth tax, you know, on all assets other than treasuries. You would, so that what you'd be doing is creating huge incentives above and beyond the interest collected to just put your park your capital in treasuries. And so, and we can look at certain economies that have some elements of this already, like Japan, which famously domestically buys all of its extremely low interest bonds, right, from insurance companies and postal savings accounts. And so there's a lot of mechanisms to kind of funnel capital into your own treasuries, if that's what, if that's the goal. So I see that, and I also see a restricting or a disruption potential for all direct foreign investment in other economies. And so that's going to hurt countries that depend on that capital. And again, it fits into this geopolitical risk scenario of where we're describing, where I could see treaties being enacted with specific countries. Well, we'll allow direct investment in your economy, but only if you can secure us access to this commodity. You know, so there's a lot of, I could see a lot of horse trading going on here, and to protect national interests. And so every country has national interests. And so we have to remember, everybody has the same right to pursue their national interest. And so what we're talking about is, what are the risks involved as the world fragments into a bunch of low-level conflicts, if you will, over national interests?
Yeah, very, very likely to happen. And just skipping down one row before we cover the transition of fiat currency to central bank digital currencies. There's been recent developments, per what you've been mentioning, on a uranium ban by Russia for exports of uranium to the West. So this could be, translating into insufficient supplies of uranium critically needed by nuclear power plants in the West. Now there's some waiver system in there, just as you pointed out, there's strategic interest that could be implemented. But essentially, this is happening now, and affecting nuclear fission power plants that may need the supply or have some sort of guarantee or of the steady supply chain management for years to come. And there's actually ways of investing in uranium directly through the one of them is the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. That's quite interesting. As holding the actual uranium in that fund in the form of a trust, as well as different type of uranium companies. Again, there would need to be a distinction between uranium companies in the Western world versus uranium companies in the global South. So some of the countries in the world are on in a bridge type of format, sort of looking at both sides. Haven't really committed to one side or the other, or are serving both sides. So those are sort of more neutral bridge countries. But what are your thoughts on this, Charles?
Yeah, it's a good example, Richard, of national interests playing out. And in other words, if you have you're a dominant supplier of a critical resource or material, then you might as well play that leverage to your benefit. And so make it a trading chip, if you will. And that goes for the suppliers and also for the buyers. In other words, the price of uranium goes up, and then there's a bidding war that would serve the national interests of the global South countries that are mining and purifying uranium, right? So there will be a lot of winners and losers and jockeying, but I can definitely foresee, like I said, domestically, the Western nations that have sort of offshored everything that was dirty and polluting in order to clean up their environment, they're going to face a quandary here, because they're going to need to restart some of these dirty industries in order to secure some kind of domestic source for these materials. And so I could easily foresee laws enacted that made it a matter of absolute national security that this mine of you know, was going to restart mining and purifying uranium. Never mind the environmental things. We'll set that aside, or we'll do what we can. But we're restarting production of essential materials, and so I think that's another factor in this whole chessboard, if you will. But yeah, everybody has the right to pursue their national interest, and whatever chips you have, whatever high cards you have, then everybody will be playing them as best as they can. And then that creates a fragmentation, I said, that creates a lot of dynamic changes in the global economy. The sort of safe, secure markets fix everything kind of, open market, free trade, all that stuff's out the window. And so it's going to be, the risk is simply to be caught off guard. When you thought that you had invested in something safe, and then the whole thing changes overnight with a treaty, a ban, or a sanction or something like that. And of course, those don't go just from the United States to some other country. They go from other countries to the United States or it's a global situation where everyone's going to start playing their cards in ways that are fragmenting and higher risk.
Yep, those are great points, Charles. The issue of central bank digital currencies is mentioned a few times in the table, and one of those risks that is interesting pointed out here is the situation on how the private-based cryptos could relate to central bank digital currencies, which are essentially government cryptos. So the risk here is on private cryptos, private cryptocurrencies that that could have either restrictions on those crypto exchanges in terms of the on-ramp or the off-ramp. So purchasing cryptocurrencies or exchanging cryptocurrencies into local government-based currencies like the U.S. dollar. And so these crypto exchanges such as Coinbase, Binance, could be involved with that. And you could have a situation where they're rolled into by governments forcing the private cryptos into government-controlled central bank digital currencies. So meaning during the implementation process as the central bank digital currencies are rolled out, which are more than likely to be rolled out by the commercial banks on behalf of the central bank. What happens is at some point there's a forcing of the private cryptos to be given a certain value by governments and folded into the government-based crypto currency, the central bank digital currencies. Some value is given. So there's a risk there. Your thoughts on this, Charles?
Yeah, it's a very interesting topic, Richard, and right on the sort of leading edge of unknowns, because cryptos themselves are rather new, and the governments around the world have approached private cryptos in a variety of ways. Some have banned them or limited them. Others have partially legalized them, and so. It seems that there's no uniform response yet in terms of national governments as to how to manage cryptos to the benefit of the national government, which of course is going to be their primary interest, right? So yeah, you can easily imagine that if private cryptos are seen as a way, an escape mechanism from central state control and taxation, that the state is going to grab control of the private cryptos by one means or another. And one, of course, is, as you say, to fold them into the central bank crypto. Another is to restrict their usage, at least their legal usage, so that everybody that attempts to transfer them to some other nation or something is now breaking the law, even if it's difficult to catch someone, that you are now a potential, felon or whatever, or very high windfall tax profits on trading cryptos, that kind of thing. And all with the idea that you and I have often discussed, along with many other people, the financial repression. In other words, the whole idea is to repress any part of the financial system that's not benefiting the nation state and its control of its domestic economy and its national, its international interests. So how that plays out, I can't make any prediction, but it's certainly easy to see how a central bank crypto could, as you say, require the substitution or some mechanism whereby the central bank crypto is the leading currency and everything else is a subsidiary of it.
Yeah, those are even other risks as well, as you mentioned, that should be considered. But it's yeah, clear as to how this is going to play out. The last one is again on the geopolitical front. This is something that we've done podcasts with Dr. Mark Farber. He's mentioned about sort of like a World War III trade for protection from an investor perspective. But the escalation of what's been happening in the Russia-Ukraine war appears to be happening. There's been announcements by Germany in early May for sending 35,000 NATO troops into the war. And by France, similarly, along with deploying troops and ammunition. So what are your thoughts on this, Charles? Because this could have ramifications in a number of areas, not the least of which on the entire global economy, the financial markets, movement to a risk-off environment, especially in Europe, and implications for the bond market as well globally. And also ensuing potential for even fiscal and monetary stimulus, right? Maybe if, God forbid, there's nuclear war, so there would be extensive monetary stimulus, but maybe it doesn't make sense at that point, right? Because if, I don't think anybody will win in a nuclear war, especially in the entire northern hemisphere. Your thoughts on this, Charles?
Yeah, I don't claim any knowledge of the war or the potential for escalation. What would be useful, of course, would be to have access to the highest level of surveillance and intelligence collection by the major governments in action here. Short of having that kind of intelligence reports, I can only hope that the history of warfare, which is of course filled with surprises and disasters and escalations and so on, that it follows some sort of track that's also has history, which is some sort of resolution. Now, this is not to discount the risks. I simply want to point out that warfare by other means is going on here too. We're discussing bonds, sanctions, it's and so on, and we're also discussing public threats and public pronouncements. But of course, there's a whole world behind that, which we know exists of diplomacy and kind of jockeying. And so we're not privy to that. So since we are not privy to those layers behind the public pronouncements, then it's very hard for us to assess the risks. But any major war has all the risks that you described, and we're all kind of sitting on the edge of our seats, hoping that wisdom and rationality eventually lead to some sort of resolution rather than an escalation. But how do we protect ourselves from that? That's a tough one, other than, of course, de-risking your entire life as much as possible. In terms of reducing your dependence on all those systems that could be disrupted, in a wider war.
So just in summary, this table is very interesting to look at. It's listing a growing number of risks, and it's updated fairly regularly. There's lots of interesting links. Even some columns further to the right of the table for other related additional links. And just wondering your final thoughts on this. A lot of these risks have emanated from an emerging sovereign debt bond crisis, especially in the indebted Western world, which has resulted in more of a multipolar type of world that has a bifurcated approach to investing. If you're an investor from the Western world versus an investor from the global South, that could determine types of investments, types of jurisdictions, types of investment approaches. But some interesting risk mitigation measures here on the positive side. But your final thoughts, overall on this, Charles?
Yeah, well, I think it's I'm of course, like I'm sure you are also, thinking of the many analysts who've described cycles. And so, like, say, Peter Turchin's 50-year and 100-year cycle of disorder and order. We're clearly in entering, or well into, a cycle of disorder, both domestically in the US for sure, and also elsewhere, and also internationally. So in this era of disorder, it's very reminiscent of like the 1600s, actually, where there was like the so-called 30-year war, where there's this endless parade of regional conflicts and the pandemics and crop failures. And so, you know, the so-called era of polycrisis, where there's a lot of crises or a lot of risk elements are pounding on the world all at once. And so that, of course, increases the risk for miscalculation. And so in a way, it feels to me like in terms of as an investor, we're all riding a raft through the rapids, because your level of certainty is pretty low in virtually every category. And so what we're looking at is, as this table often mentions, if you have tangible assets, they're more likely to stay within your ownership, because, you know, there's political reasons to not confiscate all your citizens' assets, right? You're gonna face political revolution at some point. And so if you own the assets yourself and you're aware of the risks, then you're more likely to stay in safer assets and be alert to the potential for investments that you don't really fully control being influenced by decisions made overnight, such as sanctions or lockdowns, et cetera, et cetera. So we're all on a raft in the rapids, is my view. And so that in and of itself helps us, I think, as investors, because if you don't overestimate the safety of something, then you're more likely to make a good decision or be willing to change a decision.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's been great discussion, Charles, and your insightful comments, especially leveraged from your blog posts. Many of the blog posts are referenced in the risk table here. Great to check out cedarowl.substack.com. And how can our listeners and viewers learn more about your work? If you can mention also your Substack, Charles.
Yeah, visit me at charleshughsmithsubstack.com or oftwominds.com. And Richard, I really appreciate the opportunity to discuss these major issues with you.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Charles.
Okay.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.